What? I'm in the car.
Good morning, everyone. I'm going to go ahead and open up the Senate Committee on Judiciary. And for formalities, do we want to open up the House as well?
Yes.
Okay, I'll do the gavel.
Thank you. I open up the House Committee on Human Services.
And thank you for everyone that's here today. We have a number of bills that we have before us. We have two public hearings. We have the first one is going to be on Senate Bill 10. I'll go ahead and open up the public hearing for Senate Bill 10. And the two committees are meeting jointly because the issues that are at hand, we both have separate bills that are in each of the committees. We felt the testimony that will be presented today by the Department of Human Services is important for both committees. Representative Tomei, would you like to add anything?
No, I think that's fine.
All right, with that, and what we're going to go ahead and do is first thank everyone for being here. We're a little tight. And Tim and Doug, thank you for kind of balancing out that side. And Jackie, thank you for balancing out this side. So we're going to go ahead and
get you guys on.
Well, you already did. You got your chair back. All right, we're going to start a panel from Department of Human Services, Aaron Kelly Seal, Beth Engler, and Gloria Anderson. And if we need a fourth chair, you can just bring one up if necessary. You know, if Mickey is going to be part of that panel or not. I guess not. Aaron?
Good morning, Chair Brzezinski, Chair Tomei, members of the committees. For the record, my name is Aaron Kelly-Seo. I'm the Interim Director of the Children, Adults, and Families Division. And we are here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 10, provide you some information and background on that bill, and also some information and context around House Bill 3471, which is being heard later this morning in the House Human Services and Women's Wellness Committee. I thank you very much for holding this hearing jointly so that we would have a chance to present the information to you all at once. As you know, because we've had the privilege in front of both your committees to share information about who we are in the Children, Adults, and Families Commission and what we do, we provide protective services, foster care, and adoption services for children whose safety is in jeopardy and who have been abused and neglected. Sometimes children come into our custody because of drugs and alcohol, abuse and neglect, and other reasons. And I think for both committees, we've given you an overview of some of that work and why kids come into care. When parents are not able to safely have their children returned to them, which, if you recall, does happen in about 60% of our cases, their parental rights may be relinquished or terminated, and that places us in the position of wanting to find a permanent option for that child or children. Remember that it is our philosophy that foster care should not be something a child experiences permanently, but rather we hope they will be able to find a permanent home either with an adoptive parent or with someone who would be their guardian. Whenever possible, DHS tries to place children with their families, with their relatives, and that can mean either in Oregon, in other states, and sometimes in other countries, and that's what we're here to talk about today. And I also just want to remind you that that preference that is for relatives and families was something that I believe the Judiciary Committees jointly and also the Human Services Committee supported strongly last session with the passage of Senate Bill 414, which does require, rather than just reasonable efforts to place with a relative, that the department make diligent efforts to place with a relative and family member. We don't place many children internationally for adoption. In fact, over the last 10 years, there were 27 children that Oregon placed for adoption internationally, and in my testimony, you can see the breakdown of where those children went. That happens to comprise, on an annual basis, less than 1%, in most years, less than 0.5% of our total adoption caseload. We provide adoption services and find adoptive homes for about 1,000 kids on an annual basis in DHS. Senate Bill 10 that you're considering today will enhance our practice for those international adoptions that we do become a party to, and that we are working for, that we work on for the safety of children. It requires the department to develop rules, policies, and procedures that are consistent with the Intercountry Adoption Act of 2000 and the Hague Convention on the Protection of Children and Cooperation in Respect of Intercountry Adoption. Those rules took effect for state agencies last summer, and since they took effect, since those federal laws and international laws took effect, our agency has been working on a better understanding of what it would require for us to bring our practice and policy into compliance with those regulations. We very much support those federal protections because we believe that they are designed and will enhance our ability to provide and ensure the safety of children that we place in other countries for adoption. In Section 1 of Senate Bill 10, the bill gives the department the authority to establish rules, policies, and procedures to implement these laws. And I understand there is also a dash 1 amendment that does correct one typographical error that appears in the bill on page 1, line 19, that refers to the Interstate Adoption Act. And I think the intent was that it be Intercountry Adoption Act. And it's my understanding, as I say, that you do have a dash 1 amendment, which, of course, we would support. We have several rules and policies in place already, and we've been working to strengthen our practice around international adoption really for the last several years. When we got some technical advice from the State Department, the United States State Department, about a month ago, a little more than that now, and upon recommendation of the State Department and our own Department of Justice, we did put a temporary suspension on our placements for international adoption to give us time to bring our practice into full compliance with the new federal laws. We are on track to be complete in our efforts within the goal that we set for ourselves, which was about 60 days. And so what this bill does is really solidify and codify for us the imperative that you all support for us to really take full advantage of the protections that these federal laws now afford states. And really what I would say to you that is most critical about these new federal protections is that it takes Oregon out of what I consider to be sort of an unequal relationship in dealing with other countries on a state-to-country basis and really establishes a more equal relationship that allows us to take advantage of our federal country-to-country conversation with other countries when it comes to placing children safely for adoption across borders. With me today, let me also say just briefly that there is this companion bill, House Bill 3471, which also authorizes us to implement the federal regulations and become compliant with the new federal law around international adoption, but it takes an additional step. It requires certain conditions to exist in another country before we place a child for adoption. There really are two critical junctures for us in a conversation with any adoptive parent, but in particular in the case of an adoption with another country where the issues are much more complicated and we're working with other jurisdictions. And those are the juncture of the placement decision, which requires us to have certain information on hand to be sure that the individual who is seeking to become the placement for the child would be in that child's best interest and would be a safe placement for the child. And the second critical issue for us is our ability to oversee and monitor that placement while we still have legal custody and jurisdiction over the child before the adoption is finalized. Because of the court process that occurs, it does take some time between a placement for adoption and the legal finalization of that adoption, and during that period, the department continues to have responsibility for that child. And so when dealing with other countries, what House Bill 3471 requires us to do is make sure we have agreements with those other countries about the kind of monitoring, oversight, and reporting that we will receive from them so that we have good information about what's happening in the life of that child in that placement when they are in the other country and we still are the legal custodian of that child. So I'm going to turn it over to the two women to my right. Beth Englander is our adoptions program manager. They'll both introduce themselves, I know, for the record. And Gloria Anderson is the manager of our diversity unit and unit on international affairs. Really appreciate the opportunity to be before you, and we will be available, of course, to answer questions.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Beth Englander, and I'm the Adoption Program Manager for Children, Adults, and Families Division of the Department of Human Services. I'd like to briefly share policy and procedure development activities that the Adoption Program and the Diversity and International Affairs Programs have been engaged in as we have worked toward implementation of Hague provisions in federal law in Oregon over the last couple of months. A work group that has included the Department of Justice has been meeting since early March, and we've established regular communication, as Aaron had indicated, to include ongoing general case-specific technical assistance with the U.S. Department of State. With help from State, we have been able to map federal requirements and Hague requirements to our current policy, procedure, and rule for freeing and placing children for international adoption. We're also working toward completing the following actions that I'd like to briefly go through that will bring the department into compliance, as was mentioned, with Hague provisions and with the federal law. We've been working on confirmation of required language for placement and finalization of court orders for Hague-compliant adoptions and for statewide court implementation. We've been working to determine the additional criteria that Oregon will request in in-home studies that will need to be completed by authorities in the country that's receiving the child for placement to include new requirements for a minimum number of hours of adoptive parent training and a sign-off by the appropriate central authority in the receiving country that indicates approval of the completed home study as part of the assurances that the child will be safe in placement. Additional requirements to our agreements for supervision for face-to-face contact and a regular mechanism for reporting back to the department about the child in placement to include their school activities, medical health attention, mental health attention, safety, and other well-being needs. Excuse me. We're also working on confirmation of the electronic process that the department will need to use and the documentation requirements in order to be able to obtain Hague-compliant certification and declaration that's required both for placement of the child now in the other country and for finalization of the adoption in a court in this country. We're working on amendment of existing policy, rule, and procedures for appeal. Included in the International Adoptions Policy and Procedure Manual that was recently released to the field. And finally, we're working on development of a training module which will be inserted into a draft International Adoptions training curriculum that is ready to be released to the field upon completion of all of these other pieces. I'd like to direct your attention to the draft flowchart that's in your packet that I see some of you have been looking at. It depicts the sequence of steps that the department believes we need to follow in order to identify a potential adoptive family in the other country to free and place the child and to finalize the adoption. The activities that historically take place for an international adoption are in the box under each step. And we've inserted the proposed additional actions that the department will need to complete in order for an international adoption to be Hague compliant and to be compliant with the new federal law. For example, if you look to the box labeled pre-placement, there are the two steps that are underneath that box. The first one is to obtain an IAA, which is the Intercountry Adoption Act compliant court order. And the second step would be to obtain a Hague-compliant declaration from the Department of State Central Authority. We've added those pieces to make this very easy to map to current policy, as I mentioned, and to help us to make sure that we are following all the steps that we need to take in order to dot all of our I's, cross all of our T's, and close the loop. As I've mentioned, new policy and procedure will require additional requirements in the home study and child-specific placement and supervision agreements to ensure that child safety and children's needs will be addressed in their new countries. Gloria Anderson, CAF Diversity and International Affairs Manager, will discuss some of the specifics of these elements of finalizing international adoptions.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Gloria Maria Anderson, and I am the CAF Diversity and International Affairs Manager. As mentioned earlier, we are amending existing policies and procedures to ensure compliance and add additional requirements to the home study and international child-specific agreements that we are entering into. These will help address the additional supervision and enhance safety and that other needs of children in intercountry adoptive placements are actually met. The home study, which we currently have been using over the last few years, actually was a fairly strong outline and has many of the elements that the Hague Convention requires to be within a Hague-compliant home study. However, there are elements that we are adding into that will further enhance what we have been requesting in the past. Specifically, we have added a section that addresses the reasons for adoptions. This would be the prospective parents' interest, their motivation, as well as their ability to provide for safety and mental, emotional needs of the child throughout that placement. And there is a requirement that they will also address for us the ability to enter into an intercountry adoption. The home study has further elements that we're now including, which requires that the social worker and the competent authority within the receiving agency must confirm the characteristics of the children for whom the prospective adoptive parents would be qualified to provide care for, as well as a recommendation specific to that parent's ability to provide for the safety, nurturing, and stable environment of the children awaiting placement. There are also requirements for training, 10 hours of training, minimum training, prior to the placement of a child in that home. And lastly, confirmation that that training and any special counseling regarding the intercountry adoption has taken place. In addition to the home study process and approvals from the receiving country and central authorities, Oregon, as mentioned, is requiring that we will enter into intercountry adoptive agreements for child-specific placements in the country. And these would be done prior to any child immigrating or being placed into the adoptive placement in the other country. These agreements outline some specific services to be provided to the prospective adoptive parent and to the child from prior to placement through the finalization of the adoption process. Some of those specific elements include coordinating with Oregon Department of Human Services for any aspects of the planning and implementation of pre-placement and placement activities of the child, and that after the child is placed, for that they would supervise and provide face-to-face supervision with the child and adoptive parents at a minimum every 30 days, and to document and provide to us those reports every 90 days, which would not only document when and where those contacts have taken place, but would really provide an assessment, again, of the child's physical, mental, emotional, and adjustment needs, as well as address for us the quality of the relationship as they're seeing between the adoptive parents and the child. Finally, our agreement will outline and has a section that clearly delineates the communication and coordination plan for the receiving agency and Oregon Department of Human Services should any safety threats exist or commence to exist in the placement home. Although these are no guarantees, we do believe that these safeguards will provide additional safety for children and provide benefits to the child in the placement in these intercountry adoptive placements. I thank you for this time, and please feel free if you have questions.
The other thing we provided, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, was a fact sheet, some questions that we get asked frequently with respect to international adoption. So we hope that that's informative. On the back of it, what you'll see are a list of things that we have done already to strengthen our international adoption practice, and then you'll also see a list that comes before that of the enhancements that compliance with Hague will afford the state of Oregon as we go forward.
All right, great. Thank you. We're going
to go ahead and open up the panel for questions. And all right, first I'm going to go with Representative Van Orm, and then back on this side, was it Mallory?
No.
Okay. All right. And we need to have the microphone, please.
Oh, yes.
Thank you.
If we can get it low enough. Thank you, Chair. Presuming that we adopt this and we're in the Hague Adoption Convention, when we would send children for adoption to another country, do they? My expectation is that they have also signed this convention. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Representative Van Orman, yes, that is true. There are 75 countries that have signed the treaty and the convention, and we have the expectation that we will be able to work with those countries and their central authorities, which is a new creation as part of the treaty that centralizes and really allows for some enhanced oversight in the other country of the work that happens with respect to the adoption.
Yes.
What if a country does not? If a country has not signed the Hague and they are not a convention or treaty applicant, we are not obligated at that point to follow this procedure with them according to our Hague procedures here in the United States. However, that would not be a Hague placement. An adoption could be entered into in that country, but it would not be pursuant to Hague.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. What is the date of this?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Of this document, it says we expect it to take 60 days. So there had to have been a beginning date.
Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer, I believe we are slated to be in full compliance. Beth, could you correct me by May 4th? Is that the? May 8th. And so that document, when we originally created it, was earlier in March when we started the 60-day clock ticking. But we did update it for the committee today, so I'm sorry for my...
Okay. Follow-up, Mr. Chair. Why, a year ago, we were having a conversation about international adoption in another committee. And I'm wondering why, at that point, it was, don't look behind the curtain, we've got it figured out. And then, so why are we here today with this bill, House Bill 3471 and Senate Bill 10? I mean, how come this wasn't pre-session filed?
Mr. Chair, Madam Co-Chair, Representative Maurer, the department, when it was very unclear in the beginning whether the Hague Convention would actually be applicable to public entities like the Department of Human Services. The original conversation about Hague, which did not take effect in the United States period until April of 2008, the original conversation really was centered on private adoptions that involved children who were coming into this country from other placements, from other countries. Subsequent to that, the United States State Department began to provide technical assistance, and that really didn't start until later in July of 2008, so after this body had adjourned, to states around the fact that there were protections that they would like to afford public entities with respect to international adoptions. There still remained quite a bit of confusion because, again, the original premise for those conversations centered around becoming certified, and there was a lot of confusion about whether public entities actually had to become certified like private adoption entities did. It was not until March of 2009 that we were able in the state of Oregon to receive definitive advice from the United States State Department that we didn't have to be actually certified to take full advantage of Hague, and that they would offer us the support and protections of Hague if we got our policies and processes into compliance. So we were not able to pre-session file the bill. We have, as you know, because of your conversations with us around international adoption, I think taken many, many steps to strengthen our work in that area that predate Hague. We're very well poised. And to our knowledge at this point, the states that actually do the most work internationally, some of our southern states like California, Texas, and Florida, they actually are not in compliance with Hague yet. Oregon is very much on the cutting edge, with the passage of these bills and with the efforts that our state agency is making to get into compliance with Hague.
Okay. Mr. Chair, one follow-up. Thank you. That's a very good answer. And it gives me a much better timeline as to why it occurred the way it did, because it didn't make sense during your testimony. The other piece is you talked about rules and how you're going to work with this across the state of Oregon. Seems to me if you have 27 international adoptions going out over the course of 10 years, or I think 10 or 11 years, why would you not say time out? Everything needs to come from Salem, in order to make sure we've done this process correctly, or did I misunderstand your testimony?
Well, I'll start, Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer. The bulk of the work around compliance with Hague will actually take place through the central office because we do have a lot of responsibility, the primary responsibility for some of the adoption legal and paperwork at the central office level. What we need are our field staff to be able to understand really juxtaposes with our efforts to do a better job of working with relatives much earlier on in a case. I think we've spoken before about the fact that today Oregon does place about 30% of children who are in foster care, and that same percentage usually applies to adoptions as well with family, with relatives. And we know that it is best for a child if that can happen much, much earlier in a case. And some of the challenge around that does occur when there is a relative that's been identified in another country because we're not able to place children in foster care in other countries. So that creates a lot of challenge for us around our policy internally with respect to our emphasis on placement with relatives. And we need to be able to navigate that with our field structure and be able to explain how those things work and how still relatives in other countries can be considered as adoptive resources. So there is overlay between the foster care experience and the adoption experience, but the most of the work around getting into compliance and having the communications with the State Department and with other countries will have a focus for us in our central office in Salem. And Beth can correct me if I'm misunderstanding exactly some of how this will operationalize.
And co-chairs and Representative Moore, the thing that I would add is that there are some earlier pieces that are really attached to just general permanency planning for children who may have dual citizenship or for whom we have questions about birth certificates. And as Aaron mentioned, the whole issue of diligent relative search needs to begin very, very early in the life of the case, regardless of which relatives the child may wind up with, in order to allow us to appropriately have the time to assess placement alternatives for the child and placements that will meet the best interest of the child. So this really is, it's not a terminal end procedure. This is a procedure that has its foundations in very early case planning for cases, and so we need to make sure that all caseworkers statewide understand the implications of permanent planning when a child may have a potential resource that is a relative in another country. And so this begins very early, and we have to set a foundation in order to be in the right place when we get to the steps that are outlined in the, by the time we get to the flow chart. The other thing is that, and Gloria may be able to speak more to the dual citizenship issue from her perspective as the diversity manager, international affairs manager, that becomes very, very tricky for us as well. And much of the work that is done locally for children, on behalf of children who have dual citizenship, also sets the foundation as to whether or not we're going to be able to come into compliance with Hague, with the International, the Inter-Country Adoptions Act, when we get to the point where we're considering freeing a child for placement in another country.
All right, thank you very much. I've got three people in the queue. I just want to let everyone know who I've got and make sure I get anyone else. I've got Rep. Boone, Denbro, and Senator Bonamici. Is there anyone else?
Okay. Senator, I would like to suggest that the people in the House Committee, we will continue this hearing when we move down to the first floor. So I'd like to invite the House members to hold their questions. We'll have the same panel before us, and let's let the senators ask their questions.
All right. If that's the case, will the chair, then we'll go with Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to know about the Inter-Country Adoption Act, because there's been a lot of discussion about implementing the Hague Convention, but it appears that the Inter-Country Adoption Act has been around for a long time. Has that not provided some of the protections that we're seeking by this bill? And if not, then what is it there for, and who's complying with it?
And Senator Bonamici, co-chairs, you're right. The Inter-Country Adoption Act has been around. It was signed into law by then-President Clinton, so it has been in existence for a number of years. However, up until April of 2008, federal government engaged in a basically open series of open public hearings, and the State Department was very involved, along with Customs and Immigration, in terms of figuring out exactly what the federal requirements and regulations would be to, in support of the IAA. And so the IAA actually did not become effective, as Aaron has indicated, until April of last year. And actually, state, as has already been mentioned, states were not expected to begin to develop their policies and procedures to affect the IAA until the summer last year. And it's a very, it is a very, very complicated law. And I know we still have some questions about its applicability to children who enter our custody, who may have come to this country with their biological parents from another country, who wind up subject to termination of parental rights and may be considered for placement even in this country. And so there are a lot of questions. The IAA originally was intended to be legislation that would help to control, frankly, the trafficking and sale of children internationally, and it was determined over the course of public hearings that were held in this country that it was appropriate to also extend the reach and protections and provisions of Hague to children who were being placed across international borders by state public child welfare agencies in order to give the same, as again has already been mentioned, the same level of international country-to-country assurances behind those placements. And I don't know if that answered your question or not.
It does. Thank you. And just to follow up, thank you. And Aaron, you mentioned this, that the Hague, is it called the convention, was designed to address the issue of children in other countries being adopted by adults in, for example, in the United States. Do you anticipate that this bill would affect the ability of families here to adopt children in other countries? And if so, how would that affect that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, my understanding is that the way that the bill is written is
very narrowly tailored to give direction to the Department of Human Services, and that entities already involved in private adoptions that may be international in nature in the state have already come into compliance, been certified, and they have a separate conversation, if you will, that they've been having with the State Department around their own compliance with Hague. So no, I do not believe this bill will impact what's happening privately with respect to adoptions. It's very narrowly tailored to state activity around children who are in foster care being placed for adoption in other countries. Thank you.
Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Pazanski. Mr. Seale, it's my understanding that the social workers, psychologists, and other professionals that work for Department of Human Services are not required to be licensed by the state and often are not licensed by the state in their area of expertise. Has this lack of licensing ever caused a problem, or do you perceive it would cause a problem in international negotiations regarding adoptions and family certification, family training, parent training, that sort of thing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Wittsitt, let me make a run at and see if I understand your question correctly. I think that one of the challenges for us is that with respect to international adoptions, what happens in a case is that we would receive information here from experts who know the child about what the child's needs are, what the child's challenges and strengths are, and what our job is primarily is to identify a family, hopefully a relative, a family member, perhaps someone known to the child, who is best able to meet those needs. And when we're dealing with international adoption issues, we do rely on professionals in other countries to provide us with information about the families that we are considering in those other countries as being able to meet the needs of the child that have been identified in this country. And what House Bill 3471, as well as Senate Bill 10, I think do for us is they allow us to really be more specific with respect to both what our national expectations are of those other countries and the information that they will be providing to us. But also, you know, with respect to the child-specific placement issue, which will come up in more detail with 3471, we will have the ability to be able to really get specific with other countries about what our expectations are in terms of the information that they provide us on an ongoing basis about whether, in fact, the placement is meeting the needs of the child and is continuing to be in the child's best interest after the placement is made. So I'm not sure that I hope I've tried to answer your question, because it involves professionals in two countries really giving us advice about what the issues are with respect to the child and how we meet the child's needs.
Thank you for the answer. The question was more directed toward, do the professionals in other states and other nations readily accept the opinions and written positions of DHS employees who are not licensed in their field?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I need to look more deeply into the issue that you seem to be identifying about licensure, because that's not one that I'm familiar with, and I'm happy to provide some follow-up information there. But what I will tell you is that these jurisdictional issues that involve children are complicated, because we are not technically licensed to provide to do social work in other states. So our workers cannot go into the state of Washington or Idaho or California and do social work unless they have a special license to do that. And we're also not licensed to go and do or authorized to go and do social work in other countries. So in Canada, for example, or in Mexico, or the countries that we've worked with in the past, we do have to rely on them, and they have to rely on us. And so they likewise are not authorized to do work here. So there is this exchange and parity around information that happens between professionals in different jurisdictions.
All right, Senators, any other questions? I've got two comments, maybe one follow-up. First, I want to thank the agency for putting together this flow chart. I find it personally pretty useful, and also by having the italics showing us how it actually interfaces into what is the existing process for this. And I'm following up on Senator Whitsitt's question. It's my understanding, being part of the Hague Convention, we will be kind of authorized or certified by the Hague for any other foreign country that we meet a certain standard, and that they will in fact accept no matter who's doing the work in the sense of licensing or not, but as a unit, we've been certified to meet the thresholds that are required under the convention. Is that correct?
Chair Pavansky, that is correct.
All right. Any follow-ups on that? If not, then I'm going to thank you very much for coming forward. We do have two other people that are scheduled to give testimony, at least they have signed up. It is the Crams, Tasha, and then I apologize, the other individual whose also last name is Cram. First name starts with an E, but I am not sure what that name is. So if y'all want to come forward. And good morning. Thank you for being here. If you'll give us your name for the record before you give us your testimony, that would be greatly appreciated.
My name is Tasha Marie Cram.
Okay.
And I'm here to, I guess I would say, give the reverse side of what international adoption actually has the holes to leave space for. What can happen? The kids that fall through the cracks.
All right. So, Ms. Cram, what I'm going to ask you to do, we have a bill that's before us, Senate Bill 10, and we've also opened up a public hearing on HB 3471. Your comments, are they directed toward SB 10?
They're to both anything that leaves the state thinking that we can depend on authorities to protect our children. Anything that lets them go out of country.
All right, I'm going to give you some latitude. We have a number of bills, and I'm not sure where the testimony is going to go. I may ask you to confine your testimony back to what we have before us. If you're going to give us a case-by-case base or analysis or descriptions as to what has happened in particular cases,
No, it's just basically what happens with international adoption, the holes that, and what things need to be changed to fill these holes so that the kids aren't put in danger more than they already are at home.
All right, Ms. Cram, I'm going to give you some latitude here and let you go ahead and start your testimony, but realize that if it goes beyond what I believe is appropriate for Senate Bill 10, I will ask you to address your remarks to Senate Bill 10. Please go ahead.
I wanted to start by thanking you guys, the ones that are addressing the
Ms. Cram, before you start, my counsel has told me I do need to correct the record. My understanding is House Bill 3471 is not open for hearing today. It was not posted. And because of that,
Mr. Chair, I just want to clarify, for our purposes for this hearing, it's Senate Bill 10. Representative Tomei's committee will be reconvening with 3471.
Right, and that's what I was going to say. Right. That's why I was trying to divide this up. So we're going to go ahead and let you go, Ms. Cram, as to your testimony as it pertains to Senate Bill 10.
Go figure.
I'd like to leave these anyway. These are pictures of what happens in the downfall that happens with children when they're taken into state, and how my daughter's beatings were reported to the government and the country of Mexico, and Oregon knew about it and they didn't protect her. My daughter was beaten to death because these international adoptions leave holes to kill kids, and nobody's accountable. Because lack of jurisdiction leaves them things.
Can I have a copy of the 10, because I have not seen it?
I believe there's probably a copy of the bill. Is there a bill out on the table? We'll get you one.
It's kind of hard to adhere to that when you haven't been informed.
Yeah. Well, the bill itself, Senate Bill 10, and I assume the other bill, the House Bill 3471, have been posted and have been available to the public through multiple means. So I apologize that you haven't had an opportunity to review it specifically. Mm-hmm. But if you have comments regarding Senate Bill 10, we're more than willing to take those. And if your comments may be more reflective for House Bill 3471, I know the chair of that committee will entertain that testimony later this morning.
My name is Yvonne Cram, and I'm the grandmother of a deceased child that the international, the Hague Convention, I don't understand how it could have been used to export children who are biracial, actually, because the Hague Convention was never created for that purpose. It was created in order to help other children from other countries, for us to provide them a better life, for us to save children in third world countries.
So, Ms. Cram, let me just ask you, is it your opinion that the Hague Convention was set up exclusively for children that are international to be adopted into the United States and not vice versa?
That is my understanding. I do understand that there's holes in it that have been punched in order to export biracial children. If they're biracial, then they're in jeopardy of being exported. And she's not a thing. These children aren't things. They're people. We cannot make American law in a foreign country. It's just not possible. If you were traveling in a foreign country, would you call the U.S. Embassy and let them know that you're there with your passport, or aren't you instructed to do so? They don't even know that these children are in their countries. The U.S. Embassy does not know when these kids are placed there. There is no protective mechanism other than their legal system, which is not our legal system, their Child Protective Services, which is not our Child Protective Services. We don't all play by the same rules. We don't play by the same laws. We don't have the same government. We can't expect our kids to be subjected to that. We as travelers, if we were to go to a foreign country, would end up having culture shock if we are not in a highly traveled area with a lot of other Americans. These children are dumped in places that are not they're not heavily traveled. They're the only white person in town. I mean, or a half-white person in town.
Cram, I apologize, and I'm really sorry for your loss and as your granddaughter. The bill, from my understanding, Senate Bill 10 is actually trying to establish a protocol to ensure that the foreign countries that where these children may be being placed will, in fact, have certain safeguards in place with checks and balances.
Those checks and balances were in place, and they have failed. They have already failed. They failed this child. They were notified. The state here knew. They did nothing. They had 6 months notification. If they would have told me that this danger was there, if they would have called me instead of the caseworker, I would have flew down there and got her, because I knew that our family had rights in Mexico. But that was not the case. The caseworker didn't care to tell us. They didn't. They really don't try to do a diligent relative search. I have a son that lives in Hillsborough. They never tried to contact him, but they can search out a family member in a foreign country
that the child's never met.
Right. Ladies, I'm very sorry for your loss, as I said. Regarding the situation and the bill that we have before us, the testimony has come forward is that from the department, and you may disagree with that as to how we are attempting to make certain that Oregon does in fact qualify under the process of the Hague Convention, that will in fact ensure a lot more involvement of the foreign country where the children may be placed, and that there would be additional safeguards. Again, I apologize for your loss, but at this point, it's, unless you have other testimony regarding Senate Bill 10, I'm going to go ahead and move on.
I suppose it's still failing if there was a child down there screaming in English, help me, and I told the director here that that was happening, but they don't even care to
write the name of the town.
Or the town. So there is yet another child to be murdered, and nobody to be notified because they don't have rights in a foreign country. Our children don't appear to have rights.
I think the biggest thing that I want to point out, that is no matter what kind of convention we sign, if individual states and other countries don't feel responsible to report back or fulfill their obligation when they accept United States children into their country, then why do we think they're going to respond back to the government with, you know, the convention, when they can actually be punished by the government or the federal government here, that is what the Hague Convention is under. If they are scared to report back to states, how much more fear are they going to have in their blood to actually protect these kids?
All right. Well, thank you very much for your testimony today.
Can I ask a question?
Is there anyone else who want to give testimony on Senate Bill 10? Not seeing anyone come forward, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 10 at this point. And my understanding, there's no work session that can go forward today because the appropriate documents are not here. And Madam Chair, at this point, we're going to conclude our hearing on Senate Bill 10. And I just want to make certain that the House Committee knows that we will be waiting until we get the other documentation before we have a work session. And we will report back to you as to how that goes, so you will know. And we want to thank everyone from the House side that is attending this morning. And we'll take a short recess in a second.
We'll take a short recess and we'll reconvene in hearing room.
All right, so the House committee will be in recess as well as the Senate committee until we can do the logistics. Again, thank you. We'll be right back.
didn't do anything.
Maybe next. All right, we're back on the record. Thank you for the short break to let the House members clear. We're going to go ahead and open up our next public hearing, which is Senate Bill 971. So hearing's open, Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 971 requires full reimbursement to a government agency by employee who has been trained by the Department of Public Standards and Training and voluntarily leaves employment within 1 year for a police officer, 8 months for a parole probation or corrections officer, and 4 months for a telecommunicator or emergency dispatcher. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I won't read the rest of my estimates.
Okay, I have Joel from Senator Verger's office, and Paul Snyder, why don't you go ahead and come on up, and Kevin is in writing only, okay. And I want to put on the record, I've also received testimony, written testimony, from the Oregon Council of Police Associations. Brian DeLashmet, it was required to be in another hearing, and so he's asked me to enter these into the record, so we'll have Courtney hand these out. Joel, since you're representing the senator, why don't you go ahead and give us your name and get us started.
All right. Chair Pazansky, members of the committee, my name is Joel Fisher, policy advisor for Senator Joanne Verger, District 5. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 971 and the Dash 1 Amendment. Senate Bill 971 was brought out of the need to increase retention of Oregon's public safety officials and to create a system of fairness where newly hired public safety employees are enticed to work for another higher-paying public safety agency. The state of Oregon and local governments invest precious resources in training public safety officials. For example,
according to the Department of Training,
it's been $22,039.95 to train each employee. They employ over 2,000 corrections officers. Over the last four biennium, 1,106 corrections officers left the DOC. 379 of those resigned within the first 2 years of employment. That means the DOC loses 47 employees a year, or nearly $1 million in unutilized training dollars. Public safety agencies experience turnover of new employees for a number of reasons. Scenario one, the first time a public safety officer pulls their weapon or engages an inmate or a suspect, an employee or their spouse might decide that this is not the line of work that they want to be in or that their spouse wants them to be in. Scenario two, a newly trained police officer in Portland might soon be offered a better paying job in Beaverton. This bill was drafted to address both scenarios. Scenario one is addressed in this bill by Section 2, Subsection 1. It requires newly hired employees who quit soon after being trained to reimburse the agency that trained them for those training costs. Scenario 2 is addressed in this bill by Section 2, Subsection 5. It requires agencies that entice new hires from other agencies to reimburse the agency they hired the employee from for the training costs that the previous agency paid for. There's been some opposition to the part of the bill that requires employees to reimburse training costs if they quit soon after being hired. There seems to be, however, some consensus to the part of the bill that requires agencies to reimburse each other for enticing new hires from other agencies. In an effort to ensure that at least some part of this bill moves forward, we offer the Dash 1 amendments that removes the part of the bill that requires employees to reimburse agencies, but leaves intact the part of the bill that requires agencies to reimburse each other if they entice a new hire away from another agency. Section 2, Subsection 3 and 4 detail the length of time an employee is considered a new hire and other agencies are required to repay their training costs in the event that they hire them away from the agency that trained them. Some stakeholders have expressed concern over the length of time the agencies will be required to reimburse each other. Senator Verger is interested in amending the bill to alleviate those concerns, but requests that she be given the opportunity to have this bill passed today with the understanding that she will pursue those amendments on the House side since today is the last day to schedule bills for a hearing. The intent of this bill is not to limit the employment opportunities of public safety employees, but to prevent agencies from losing the precious resources they invest in training new employees. It is simply not fair for agencies that hire new employees who have recently been trained without having to invest in their training, especially when the agency that spent the money training them is forced to hire a new employee and spend even more of their limited resources training them. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you. Paul?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and we are appearing this morning in support of Senate Bill 971 in concept. And we would like, first of all, to thank Senator Verger for addressing an issue that's widespread and of concern to many public bodies. The training costs for public safety employees can be significant, and to lose the amount of money that counties and others invest before you recoup the cost, it's unfortunate and it's not good public policy. We knew when we had a conversation about this bill that amendments would be forthcoming, but we didn't know exactly what they would look like. And so when we discussed it without a quorum, we had a vote and supported Senate Bill 971 in concept with the hope that we could work with Senator Virgin, with this committee and others to come up with language that fits the situation. We have no problem with the amendments and share the concerns that some law enforcement agencies have raised about the difficulty or even the wisdom of keeping people on in a position when for a number of good reasons they feel that compelled to leave. And so we support the amendment in concept, we support the bill in concept, and we'd like to work with Senator Verger to do what we can to make it work.
All right, thank you. Questions for our first panel? Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. Just more than a comment, I think what really wasn't mentioned here is that many of these agencies hire someone and they may pay them 6 months or more while waiting to get into a class at DPSST. So there's they're doing busy work, doing whatever, but they're sort of in a holding pattern. Then the agency pays for the training at DPSST. Then often there is a, like with the state police, for lack of a better word, an internship that they go through after the training with another individual. So there's a great deal of money invested by these agencies. And they often lose those employees to another agency who is willing to pay a little more and perhaps is able to pay a little more because they didn't go through the training. I frankly like the bill the way it was written in the first place, where the employee is also required to pay part of it. But I would support the bill either way. But there is a major problem here.
Okay, I understand. Any other statements or comments?
Ditto.
All right. So, and I clarify that a little bit. Not only are they paying them let's say academy, they're also are paying them during the academy.
Yes.
And it's true. I mean, there's I think some work here that could be done. The issue we do have now is timing is late. Joel, the one thing I do want you to make certain that the Senator understands, we can't move the bill at this point, even if we wanted to move the bill, because we just received the amendment. Without the amendment being in our possession sooner, we have not been able to even request the fiscals that are necessary to move a bill. So this will have to be put on hold for that to occur. And then during that time, we'll have an opportunity to discuss what and how we may be able to facilitate the bill if that's the desire of this committee. So let me go ahead and I'll let you all step back. I've got some other people who want to give testimony. I got Larry Hatch and Mac Jaffe that want to give testimony. And I've already put on the record, but I want to put on the record again. Kevin Campbell, the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, has submitted written testimony. Brian Glassman with his organization, Oregon Council of Police Associations, we have his testimony. He is in the room now. And Brian, did you want to say anything else besides, I'm not asking you to run up here, but if you want to, I want you to come up now.
I had the signal.
All right, thank you very much. Gentlemen.
Chair Brzezinski and committee members, I'm Larry Hatch, here today representing the Oregon chapters of the Association of Public Communication Officials and the National Emergency Number Association. Our chapter is made up of a broad base of communications officials from across the state of Oregon, large centers and small, and we understand what the bill is attempting to solve, but we oppose the bill and we think it would be unmanageable for us. If the bill were enacted, we're concerned about certainly the costs that might come with that individual and then making a hiring decision. Are you going to hire one that's going to come to you with a, you know, we're uncertain what how the dollar costs would be figured and what, you know, how much money we would be talking about having to reimburse another agency. in our agency, we've worked, you know, this is really a retention problem, and I've tried things from soup to nuts on this. I looked at contracting employees, and my legal counsel steered me away from that. I put in a signing bonus program to try to entice lateral entries to come to our agency, and gave our employees who enticed someone to come to our agency a bonus. That failed miserably. So what we found for retention, the best thing to do was to work on our agency culture and put things in place that made people want to stay at our organization and not move somewhere else. So I'd be glad to answer any questions if you have any.
All right, Matt, why don't you put your testimony on and then we'll open it up for questions.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Matt Jaffe. I'm with the City of Portland. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you this morning. And I'd also like to thank Senator Berger for her work on this issue. As noted in earlier testimony, the city does have concerns regarding the length of time the Portland Police Bureau would be required to reimburse another agency for training costs. We do feel that the 3 to 4 year time period is too long. We've expressed these concerns to Senator Berger and her staff and are committed to working with them to take care of that and further amendments either in this committee or in the House. With those amendments, the city is neutral this bill with the dash one amendments.
All right, thank you. Questions for either of these gentlemen? Senator Boromici.
Thank you. Mr. Hatch, you mentioned something about attempting to deal with this issue in contracts. Do your employees have employment contracts?
No.
Thank you.
All right, anything else? Gentlemen, thank you very much. And is there anyone else that didn't sign up on Senate Bill 971 that would like to give testimony this morning? Not seeing anyone, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 971. And I think for formalities, we will be scheduling this for a work session for next week. We want to make certain that it stays alive as to our deadline for today. And so council will take care of making sure that gets set for sometime next week. And council will work with the Senator Verger's office as to any other type of, let's say, modifications. I would strongly urge you, based on the testimony I've heard today, to look. I have not had an opportunity to go through the dash one since we just received them, but there seems to be some concerns as to the length of time and pro rata basis. Those things probably need to be addressed. All right, anything else? Thank you very much. We'll go ahead and officially, again, close the public hearing on Senate Bill 971. Okay. So I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on 262.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 262, we heard on April 9th, this is the Justice Brewer's bill for trying to save money that Court of Appeals. It allows judges to sit in panels of two to hear and decide cases. It allows pro tem judges. It allows a motion appellate commissioner and limits de novo review. It's a gut and stuff bill, dash one amendment. There is no revenue impact. There's a fiscal statement, and it is indeterminate. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, so the chair would entertain a motion as it pertains to the dash ones.
We've already put the dash ones in that. I believe that works.
No, that does not.
Okay. Mr. Chair, move the dash ones into 262.
Senator Boromici moves, Senator Volquist moves the dash one amendments into Senate Bill 262. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Chair, move SB 262 as amended by the dash one to the floor with the two pass.
Senator Boquist moves the Senate Bill 262 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Senator Boromici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to follow up on a question that I asked when we had this bill up for a hearing about the workability of a panel of two, and asked if there would in fact be a de novo hearing if it was determined at some point that they needed to call in a third judge to break the tie. And I'll support the bill with the understanding the way my question was answered from Judge Brewer was that they anticipate that that would happen in very few cases because it seems like it would be inefficient to start over again. And there's no way to tell at the beginning if you're going to anticipate it.
Judge Brewer's here, but let me just put on the record as to my understanding and my discussions with him. If that should happen, it would in fact start over, go into the cycle for being put out for the bottom line, that everyone would hear the same thing at the same time instead of having asking someone to, let's say, review whatever record might be there, not being able to participate in a de novo hearing. And I see Judge Brewer kind of shaking his head in a up and down motion, meaning a yes.
Nodding.
That's a nod? That's
yes.
A nod. Okay, a nod up and down. And so any other comment or any objection, so ordered. And the chair will carry this one on the floor. And we'll close the work session on 262. And what else do we have ready for you on your part?
Yeah, 306. Thank you for carrying over 274.
Okay, this one here. Carry over anything else to carry over? Okay, so this is yours, and 306 is ready to go.
Yeah.
All right, what I'm going to do is open up a public hearing for the purpose of carrying over Senate Bill 274. 274 is not ready to go. We have not received the necessary paperwork and to move the an amendment and to adopt the bill. So that one's going to be carried over today is the 17th. We'll carry that over to
Monday
and see if the paperwork's caught up. If not, the plan will be to continue to carry it over day by day. So that one's going to be carried over to Monday, April 20th. And I'll close the public hearing work session on 274. And at this point,
off the press, we got 274.
Okay. Well, what we're going to do is I'm going to go ahead and we may come back to 274 later this morning.
I'm really confused.
Well, I'm just, you know, I want everyone to have an opportunity to review it.
Yeah, okay.
So yeah. I think at this point we're just going to move through this stuff and we may come back to it. I want everyone to have an opportunity to review that. So the other one you have on your calendar is 306?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
So we're opening up a work session on Senate Bill 306.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 306, we heard on February 24th. This was the increasing demand limit of small tort actions. And we had a small work group get involved, and they added some days for notice, 10 days to 20 days. They added a notice to the defendant that they had to include the medical records and property damage records if applicable. It requires the plaintiff to continue to provide that information until litigation. And we also have that's the -6 amendment. We have a -7 amendment, which does the same increase of the money for small contract actions, and these are small torts and contracts that are intending to encourage out-of-court settlements before you go to court. So we have a -6, which has a minimal fiscal impact, and we have a -7 that has an indeterminate fiscal impact, and it's up to the committee which one we want to decide to move today. Do not move both. Move one or the other.
Okay.
Because they do the same thing. The -7
adds
the contracts.
The small contracts.
And the -7 and the -6 are identical, except the -7 adds the contracts.
All right. So in other words, the -6 is more in line with what the bill originally had proposed. The -7, if I understand this correct, included a different group of cases that would, in fact, get the same benefits from the intent of 306.
Can I speak to that, Mr. Chair?
All right, so floor is open. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The -7 amendment is my amendment, basically, because I had originally planned to draft a bill to do the same thing with regard to contract claims as was included for tort claims in Senate Bill 306. When legislative counsel pointed out that there was already a bill amending the same statute and doing basically the same thing for tort claims, I simply made the, instead of, this is government efficiency, instead of making a separate bill, I simply put the provisions into an amendment that turned out to be the Dash 7 amendment, because it seems consistent to me. If we're raising the amount for tort claims, it should be raised for contract claims as well. I must say that I'm a bit baffled by the difference in the expected fiscal impact. The whole purpose of both of these bills, well, the bill, but the bill and the amendment, is to encourage early settlement of cases, especially small cases. As you recall from the testimony, that this particular amount hasn't been raised for a while. This is bringing in line with, I believe, Washington and some other states. And the purpose of it is to settle cases in advance. What happens if the plaintiff makes an unreasonably high demand, they won't be awarded attorney's fees, and if the defendant ignores a legitimate demand, they'll be required to pay the claim plus the attorney's fees, and the net result is that fewer cases are going to go to trial. That's the purpose of this, is to motivate parties to settle before the lawsuits are filed. And so why there would be a difference in fiscal analysis for tort claims versus contract claims doesn't make sense, and why there would be an expected increase in litigation under this is confusing to me, because the purpose of it is really to incent settlement before cases go to trial, which should result in a decrease in the trial court docket and a reduction in caseload. So I'm, as I said, a bit baffled by this. I'm willing to follow up on it, but I really believe, after talking with the proponents of the bill, that is the intent, and then in practice that's what will happen. So I looked at the fiscal analysis, which I just received yesterday, and it states that they assume that the ability to recover attorney's fees in a broader range of cases may provide an incentive to file more cases, and I don't think that is consistent with the intent or the provisions of the bill. And certainly if it's true in one half of it, it's true in the other half. So.
All right. Senator Boquist.
Question to counsel. The Dash 6, the small work group, can you define who is in the work group? And I see some of the issues that were raised in testimony have been resolved, but who is in the Dash 6 work group? And then I'm not sure I understand page 2 of the Dash 7, but I'll ask that question in a second.
Okay. Senator Boquist, Chris Parta from OTLA was part of the work group. And Inga Deffert from, now I don't remember the name.
The Council of Defense Lawyers.
Civil Defense Lawyers. They were the key players on the work group, I believe. And both of them are here today, so they could speak more to
it. My only question is I know that there was testimony in the original hearing, and one of the insurance companies, raised issues, and at least two of three of their issues appear to have been resolved in the work group. So I just wanted to figure out.
And I have not heard from the insurance companies what their thought about the
Follow-up question, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Page 2 of Senator Bonamici's Dash 7 amendment, which I assume was not through the work group, but the only question I have in there is that Section 2 bold, this appears to make this retroactive. Not a lawyer. Can you explain Section 2 in English to me? How's that?
You're correct. Section 2 bold is a retroactive provision.
And what does, in a law like this, again, I'm not a lawyer, in a law like this, what does that mean? Does that mean in cases that have been already filed or pending? Is it cases that, I don't know what that means.
Senator Boquist, it means that you can It applies to all causes of action, whether arising before, on, or after the effective date of the act. So causes of action are when you file a case. So it applies to cases that are filed before.
But it's not that have already been determined.
No.
So it wouldn't be retroactive that way.
No, it just applies to actions that have happened before.
And just to educate me, maybe.
I don't know how that ended up in there. I never intended it to be inconsistent with the provisions of 306.
And I need to look at 306-6 to see if...
I'm only confused.
Maybe Chris Carter can...
This is...
I don't know.
Do we want to call?
There's the dash 6.
Yeah, that one that makes...
didn't get my hand.
One thing I would just in conversation.
Hang on one second. Senator West said
The statement here in the fiscal report that if plaintiffs have an economic interest in recovering attorney's fees, then some of those cases currently filed as small claims contract cases may be converted to civil contract cases confirms my concern about this bill from the beginning.
Okay.
So I have to have some real deep concerns here.
I understand. You got to watch me.
My name is Neil Jackson. I originally testified in favor of the original Senate Bill 306. If I could answer some of the questions that I've heard from the gallery. Senator Boquist, you asked who was on the work group. State Farm representative was there, Steve Merle. Billy Syme from the Oregon Association of Defense Counsel was there. Inga is here in the room. She was there also. She represents the OADC. I was there. Another member from OTLA, Chris Barter, was there. And there was a representative on another bill there for another issue. But those were the parties that were there at the work group. The next question I believe you had, Senator, was the effect on retroactivity in the Dash 7s. If I could explain that, Senator. If the action arises before the adoption of the Act,
it still would be subject to the Act.
But it only applies to actions that are filed after the effective date of the Act. In other words, let's say an action arose tomorrow, and this Act doesn't go into effect until next January. If the demand letter is sent and the lawsuit is filed before the Act is in effect, this would not apply. This Act would not apply. Does that clear that up?
No, it doesn't, because it's right out of what I just
read. And I would defer to Mr. Jackson's interpretation. And I look, and line 11 on page 2 says it does not apply to an action that was filed before the effective date of this Act. So.
So if you could just repeat that one more time,
okay.
Slowly for me.
Okay. I apologize, Senator.
No, you did a good job. I'm just got to get it to absorb here.
All right. If the cause of the tort or the breach of the contract occurs tomorrow, and so the plaintiff figures it out, and a month from now they send a 10-day demand letter intending it to be under this Act. If they file the lawsuit within 10 days, this Act will not apply, because this Act only applies to lawsuits that will be filed after January 1st of next year.
I understand now. Got it.
All right. And then I thought there was another question, but I can't remember what.
No, it was more of a comment, Mr. Jackson. So I guess since you are up here, one of the things that we have between us is if we are going to move the bill forward, we take one of the two, have the proponents of the original bill taken a position as to their preference of going with either the Dash 6 versus the Dash 7, with the understanding that the Dash 6 currently has a minimum fiscal impact. The other one is determinative. My understanding is at least the Dash 7s would have to go or would go to Ways and Means for some review, if I understand that correct. And we got two other chairs here from my discussion. I think that's what they said would happen. And on the minimum impact, I think that is one that may not need to go forward, not forward, down to Ways and Means for review. So do you have a position as to where the proponents are as to the Dash 6 or Dash 7s today?
We like them both, but we don't think it makes a lot of sense to not bring the contract actions along. And one of the reasons that we think that is so is because Senator Bonamici, in her explanation, was absolutely correct. These two, they cause cases to settle. I can tell this committee that since January, I filed 10 under the previous statute, and 8 of those have already settled. We just got the papers filed. We've negotiated a settlement. They're done. They're not going to impact the court system at all.
All right.
And I've got another one settled today. So we do think, if I may, the other thing is, I think that the fiscal is incorrect, because...
Right. That's good enough. Let me do right. This.
Just follow-up question. Just
right. I'm going to get questions, then I'm going to tell you where we're going with this.
I just want to... So what you're saying is the work group also looked at the dash seven, and the work group as a whole were comfortable with it. Let's say they liked it. Let's say they're comfortable with it. All members of the work group.
We didn't look at the dash sevens, and the reason that we didn't was because the parties that were there were only addressing the tort aspects of it at that time, because that's all we were directed to look at.
Right. My understanding is maybe the dash sevens really came into play after the work group had actually met on the dash sixes?
Pretty much.
Okay. So this is what I think we need to do. I'm going to carry this over till Monday. I'm going to allow everyone who has any interest in this to powwow, get together, whatever it is, talk today, and then get clarification on the fiscal as to why there is a difference between the two, and then we'll consider that where we may go on Monday. So Senate Bill 306 is going to be carried over until Monday, April 20th, and for an additional work session or possible work session. And at this point, we are going to close that work session. And we're going to change counsel. Thank you very much, Anna, for being here this morning. All right. So I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on Senate Bill 265.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 265. We've already adopted the dash one amendments. We have the fiscal, which is indeterminate, allows the presiding judge of the circuit court to establish a mental health court program.
Chair, members of the committee, that's basically what the bill is.
All right. And we need to move this one down?
It has a ways, subsequently for all the ways and means.
All right.
Chairman of the committee.
So do we have a fiscal?
Do we have a fiscal?
I just got it this morning. I hope it's... Okay. I read it this morning. I got it like 8:15.
All right. Well, let me tell you.
Let me see. I thought I had it in my file. I think I gave it to someone to copy. Chair, members of the committee, maybe you could do this. 253, we have the dash 5 amendments, the dash 3 amendments. I could explain those. I think we need further discussion from the District Attorneys Association and the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association concerning their still differences, which do seem to be narrowing. And right. In the interim, I'll go get you the fiscal.
All right, so what we're going to do here, I'm going to recess Senate Bill 265. And we'll bring that back up in a moment. And at this point, should I be opening a work session on both of the two bills, the 253 and the 289?
Mr. Chair,
we're going to be discussing.
You could do that. Yeah.
I'm going to do that. Then I'm opening work sessions on 253 and 289, and I'm going to ask the parties that are involved on 253 and 289, Gail Meyer as well as Brad Berry. To come forward so we can kind of get an update as to where we're at.
Yes, three on that. Mr. Chair, if you want, I can briefly go through the dash
yes.
three amendments. Chair, members of the committee, you may remember this bill, this issue being the recordation. This is on 253, I'm sorry, Senator. We have the dash three amendments in front of you, and these represent a continuing narrowing of the differences between the parties, and basically the bill and the amendments require a custodial interview conducted by a law enforcement agency, and a law enforcement facility shall be electronically recorded in connection with a person felony. That if you go to the back part of the bill, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that part of the bill doesn't take effect until 2011. What would take effect in January would be if the it's an interview of a minor, a non-English-speaking person, or it's a homicide case, unless it starts off and the police do not know it's a homicide case and the discussion comes out that leads to that. You have, going back to page 1, does not when it, and section 2, when it does not apply. It does not apply to a statement made before a grand jury, a statement made on the record in open court, custodial interview, custodial conducted by a federal law enforcement officer,
a statement was spontaneously made, a statement made during arrest proceedings in response to a routine question, a custodial interview which the state demonstrates good cause for failure to electronically record the interview. And the main issue here in page 2 is still the issue of what happens if it's not done, and in page 2 it says the court shall instruct the juror regarding the legal requirements. That would be the penalty. Going on to section 6, what the main difference here is that the statement, and this would be of advantage to law enforcement and probably potentially save a court time and overtime, and that is the recorded statement could be used in and of itself to prove the proof of the statement involved in a pretrial or post-trial matter. So, for example, before a grand jury, they could bring the recordation into the grand jury and not necessarily have to bring the police officers. And that's, as I said, section 6 on page 2. On the other part of the bill, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if you go over to page 5, and this is an exception to the recordation, this would be a one-party recordation provision, so only the police would have to assent to the recordation. The defendant would not, and the statement would still be, recording would still be valid. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's a rough translation of the amendments.
All right. So what we're going to do is go ahead and allow the interested parties to give us their comments. I know they have been working diligently and seeing if they can find some common ground in both of these bills. And I will tell the committee we do have another bill that's set for hearing on Monday, Senate Bill 309, the vehicle that would allow the two bills to be merged into one. And with that, I'll go ahead and open up for whatever perspectives you want to give us as to where we might be today on the two bills that are before us today.
Thank you, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. The -3 amendments do represent OCDLA's effort yet again to accommodate the concerns expressed by law enforcement or the District Attorney's Association. I can tell you that at this point, as to every aspect of complaint about the actual methodology of securing a recorded statement, we have yielded on every point that's come to us. And at this point, really now, it remains an issue of policy, I think, for the legislature to determine, is it good sound public policy for Oregon to require recorded statements of interrogations on person felonies in law enforcement facilities. Hopefully you've been passed out. We would be joining the good state of Montana that just signed a law on Wednesday. Their governor just signed it on Wednesday. Their law reads very similarly to our own. It reads very similarly to our -2 amendments. It does not go as far as we've gone now in our -3s. So in our -3s, we have added the provision that in pre-trial proceedings and in post-trial proceedings, the officer need not show up in the courtroom. The certified copy of the recorded statement would be admitted on its own evidence, just come into evidence. And we think that that will net a lot of cost savings for the agencies, the law enforcement agencies, because they won't need to pay overtime costs for their officers to sit there in the courtroom for the mere purpose of getting the statement into evidence. So between the phase-in, the graduated phase-in, and those cost savings, we think those agencies will recognize and realize enough money to pay for equipment plus more. It'll be at actual net savings for the agencies because of that provision. The other provision that we've added now in the -3s that Montana did not require is an exception to the two-party consent rule. I just spoke with the president of the Montana Criminal Defense Lawyers. He confirmed for me Montana is a two-party consent state, like Oregon. They have an exception for taped phone conversations, like Oregon. But in all face-to-face conversations, like Oregon, they're a two-party state. So they passed their bill notwithstanding that. We are carving out yet again another exception to accommodate law enforcement's concerns that when they are in a law enforcement facility as defined and they're conducting a custodial interview pursuant to this act, then it is an exception to the two-party consent rule.
We have yet to receive any concrete proposal from the opponents of what it is they would need to actually reach consensus. Them at every juncture. Chair Przanski, if I might, at this moment perhaps, I have assured the ACLU I would state into the record their concerns about the exception in the dash threes to the two-party consent rule. The ACLU does have a concern about the larger policy issue raised by creating an exception to the two-party consent rule. And they note that in general conversations in Oregon, we have an expectation of privacy that one person is not recording the other. And this, the dash threes would carve out an exception here, allowing law enforcement to record without the consent or even meaningful notice to the other person. And at the same time, there would not be reciprocity. If at any time an individual or citizen wanted to surreptitiously record a law enforcement officer, that would remain a crime. And they understand the important policy issues that we're trying to achieve through our bill, but they felt it was important to put their concerns on the record, and I do so now.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, I'm Bradbury, Yamhill County District Attorney, and I chair the Oregon District Attorneys Association Legislative Committee. We've not made any secret of the difficulty that we have with this bill. I do think it's important to again state that we prefer a Senate Bill 111 type review of this and developing good policies throughout the state to encourage recordation rather than having it mandated. And I just remind the members of the committee of that. I would take some issue with one of the statements by Ms. Meyer in that we have not stated what we would do. I don't think that's quite accurate. We have resisted. We don't think recordation is necessary, even though a good idea, it's not necessary to be mandated. But in fact, all along, Mr. Neely has indicated certain points that we would agree to. And in fact, we had another long discussion at our legislative committee meeting just last night, which was followed by about a 1:20 a.m. Note to Ms. Meyer indicating here's where we moved to already. So I just want to make it clear that we have been negotiating. We're negotiating in good faith, even though, and candidly, we don't believe that this is a good idea. At this time, though, there are a couple things I think that we could agree on. First, assuming that the policy of this committee would be to mandate recordation, we could live with mandating recordation on homicide cases, of course, once it's known to law enforcement that it is a homicide. We could agree to mandatory recordation where an interpreter is used. And we agree with the good cause exceptions. Obviously, I thank OCDLA for listening to our concerns there and including the good cause exceptions that have been included there. Again, these are custodial interviews which occur in a law enforcement facility. I just mentioned to Ms. Meyer that in the dash threes, there is the use of the term custodial interview, which at least by case law is not limited to law enforcement facilities. And so that the record is clear, I think the intent here, Ms. Meyer is nodding in agreement, that it include those interviews that occur in a law enforcement facility. And I think it's important to recognize that that's the limitation here. The remaining sticking point, and I'm sure Mr. Neely will wrap me upside the head if I've forgotten something, but the remaining one deals with the cautionary jury instruction. Currently, as you know from previous testimony, there is a cautionary jury instruction in place, which states that a jury should take caution when taking the statement or admission of a defendant, and it kind of goes through this, but if you believe that it's accurate, you can weigh it as you wish. I'm not quoting it, obviously. Ms. Meyer has it here. We think that instruction is adequate in a circumstance where a recording is not made. So if, in fact, the statement of the defendant is recorded, as directed here, then our proposal at this point would be that that cautionary instruction on defendant's statements need not be given. If it's not recorded, then the instruction that we currently have under defendant's statements, and I'll turn this if counsel doesn't mind, Uniform Criminal Jury Instruction Number 1022, that instruction is adequate as it stands today. Lastly,
I think we have some agreement, at least between OCDLA and ODAA, on one-party consent. And just remind the members of the committee that I recognize this is a policy decision, but what we're trying to avoid is the chilling effect of announcing that it's being recorded to a potential suspect. I thank Senator Whitsitt for meeting with us this morning, expressing some of his comments on this issue, but just remind you where we are there. The one last thing, I guess the second last thing, because I said one last thing already, is that we continue to oppose expanding this automatically to all person felonies in 2011. I think the better approach is, let's limit this, let's see how it works. We come back in 2011, if in fact it's been as good as OCDLA would has been championing, then I think you're going to find ODA comes forward and we say, we don't care if you expand it. If there have been problems, we ought to be able to bring those back before this committee or whatever committee it's assigned to and show those problems that have occurred where it would be unwise to expand this beyond homicide cases, those or those cases using an interpreter.
All right. Any other comments? Ms. Meyer.
And members of the committee, I just, in looking at the Uniform Jury Instruction 1022, which exists right now, it really ought to be our Exhibit A of why a mandate is important. What goes on now when you have an officer testify as to statements made by the defendant during an interrogation? It's just the officer repeating and relating what it is the defendant said. Then the jury's instructed to consider that testimony with caution and pose the following questions. Did the defendant make the statement? And if so, did the defendant clearly understand what he or she intended to say? Did the witness, the officer, correctly hear and understand what he said? Did the witness correctly remember and relate what the defendant said? And did the witness intentionally or mistakenly alter some of the words used by the defendant, thereby changing the meaning of what was actually said? These are all the reasons why recording make good policy.
All right. Questions? Comments? Yes. We are. All right. So with that, thank you very much for coming forward and giving us a, let's say, a summary of where we are today.
Yeah, the other bill.
The other bill.
289. Yeah. Did y'all want to put talk about the, I guess, 289?
Interpreter, translator.
Chairman Zansky, members of the committee, again, Brad Berry from the Oregon District Attorney's Association. Unfortunately, I think we just have a fundamental divide between ODAA and OCDLA on the not on the purpose of 289. They certainly understand what we're seeking to do to avoid the double hearsay issue. But I just, at least I don't think that we're close enough. I mean, we've moved, they've moved on the other one, that we really to achieve what we think needs to be achieved on 289. From our meeting with you, Chair, it appears that we just can't quite get the bridge across that divide between the two positions.
Okay. Any other comments, questions?
Can I state our position?
Yes.
Yeah. Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, with respect to Senate Bill 289, I would agree with Mr. Berry's assessment. We would agree to the bill if there was a requirement that those on-the-scene conversations be recorded. Then we think that our assurances would, we'd have sufficient assurances, we wouldn't oppose it then.
All right. Thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and close the work sessions on 289 and 253, and we're going to reopen the work session on 265.
Chair members of the committee, you have the fiscal in front of you, which is basically indeterminate. Basically, I think it says that because it doesn't mandate a mental health court. It gives the court the option of doing it, and many courts in many places have already done this.
Questions?
This has a referral downstairs.
The committee has a prior referral to Ways and Means Committee.
You want to move it down?
Yeah.
Do we have to move the dash one? The dash one out?
Dash one had already been adopted.
Just moving
the amended version.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 265 with the dash one. I guess it do pass the referral to Ways and Means.
All right, Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 265 as amended by the dash ones with the due pass recommendation to
Ways and Means for, as required by the previous referral. Any discussion?
A quick discussion, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Just for the record, I see this as having both a positive ability to save money and a negative ability to spend money potentially. So I'll support it. If I knew it was a net negative, I might be a little nervous about it, but I think Ways and Means are going to figure that out.
Thank you. At this point, we've not sent many bills down from the Senate side as to ones that they need to review, but this is one that seems like it should be in the mix because of the potentials on savings and for efficiency as to the individuals that would be within this realm of a court. So any objection? All right, so ordered. No carriers needed since it's going to Ways and Means. And council. All right, we'll close the work session on 265. And
I'll make so many chairs on here.
You bet. All right, so at this point, I'm just going to go over what I have marked down. We have two bills that are moving, carried over, and just want to make certain I've got this correct. Senate Bill 274 as well as Senate Bill 306, both of those were carried over until Monday, April 20th, and then we're going to go ahead and officially carry over Senate Bill 253 and 289 also to Monday, April 20th, so they can be paired together or stayed in line with the bill that we currently have scheduled for Monday, 309. Is there anything else that we need to cover?
Chairman, I don't know of anything else to be covered.
All right.
What time are we meeting on Monday?
We're scheduled to start at 8. I don't have a calendar, or I should say an agenda for that day with me right now. So, Courtney, do you know what we're looking at?
Chair, members of the committee, I do know we have this bill. We have the bill that relates to the Buchholz decision for the first time for hearing and work session, possible work session. It will be a lengthy discussion on legal issues.
All right. I think what council is saying is we're meeting at 8. Is that going to work for everyone, or should we fudge a little bit and go backwards in time?
7:30.
You mean start earlier? No, thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Okay, then we'll stay with 8 instead of 7:30. All right, so that will adjourn until Monday morning at 8 a.m. Thank you. Michael.